Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for April 19th, 2017. This is the Sixth Symphony by Anton Bruckner in a performance led by Andras Nelsons that we broadcast on the radio last Saturday night from Symphony Hall. It was one part of a program we previewed last week on the podcast. Mitsuko Uchida was the soloist in Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20 on the first half, and you can hear the entire concert on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. It's a bit early in the week for this podcast to drop, and it showed up today because of what's on the podcast. The Celebrity Series of Boston just announced their 2017-2018 season this morning, and Gary Dunning, the president and executive director of the Celebrity Series, stopped by to preview it with me. Also on the podcast is a conversation with Catherine Manson from the London Haydn Quartet. Kathy Fuller brings you a performance by the London Haydn Quartet, which was presented by Boston Early Music Festival on Sunday night at 7 on WCRB in concert. As for our live Boston Symphony broadcast this week, Andras Nelsons leads an all-Mozart program that starts with the Piano Concerto No. 24 with soloist Radu Lupu and ends with the Requiem. And again, to hear what Andras Nelsons has to say about it, just check out last week's episode of The Answered Question. When Gary Dunning stopped by the station to talk about the Celebrity Series 2017-2018 season, he and I talked through a lot of the specific programs, which include the Los Angeles Philharmonic playing Shostakovich, Martha Argerich playing Prokofiev with the orchestra of the National Academy of St. Cecilia, and the NEC Philharmonia celebrating both the centenary of Leonard Bernstein and the 150th anniversary of the New England Conservatory. We also touched on Pipa virtuoso Wu Man's program with a shadow puppet company, and what looks like a fascinating concert pianist Jeremy Denk put together around the violin sonatas by Charles Ives. But we also talked about some bigger picture issues, like how the tastes of audiences are changing, what audiences want from a subscription, and what Gary Dunning himself is learning from the Stave Sessions, a sort of offshoot series of edgy cross-genre artists. Here's our conversation.
I always, just because of my own predilections, I have to confess that the first thing I go to in the Celebrity Series announcement is the orchestras, because I'm a huge fan of orchestras, and especially for a town like Boston with a major league orchestra of its own, I think it's so healthy to bring in major league orchestras from other cities. It really gives us a perspective on the BSO and lets us hear other voices. So tell me about the two major orchestras that you brought in for the coming season.
Sure. I think I would agree completely that I think we offer a compliment. The BSO is clearly one of the top in the world. And that's pretty hard to match. I mean, so we sort of feel that pressure. But we like the notion of bringing both American and European orchestras just to sort of see, do they sound different? How do they sound different? And particularly when they have, you know, relationships with their conductors, like the one that's being built and thriving between Andras and the musicians. We think it's a great compliment. So we're bringing back the Los Angeles Philharmonic with Dudamel conducting.
Yeah.
He's, you know, clearly a powerhouse, you know, conductor and leader for that organization. It's really thriving. On all fronts, it has been. And again, they're pretty forward-thinking in their programming. Shostakovich 5 is quite traditional. It'll be interesting to hear that particular sound out of that orchestra.
Yep.
But then programming, you know, Verez, Edgar Verez, the Amorique, you know, I think is, I haven't heard that in years and years. And then, of course, a new work by Salonen, who has such a long association with him.
What do you know about the new work? Is this?
I know very little.
So it's not the cello concerto that was just premiered.
No,
it's
going to
be a brand new
work. It's a brand new work that he's working on now, as far as I understand. It has not premiered yet.
Okay.
And with that long association, I think it continues their commitment to new works, which I think a lot of people are interested in.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, pretty gutsy to bring in a Shostakovich symphony in the middle of this BSO project that's going on right now, huh?
It is, I think. You know, sometimes people ask me, you know, are they really in competition? Do they think that way? And I think sometimes it is just a matter of timing. It's a matter of what do they have in repertory, or what are they showing elsewhere on their tour. I don't think at all is a Boston, take this and let's see what you got.
Right.
Although clearly it is something that you know, Dudamel, as all music directors do, they want to program things that they like to conduct and they think that showcase the orchestra well.
Yeah. Well, and really, when you start talking to musicians about this stuff and even the people who run the orchestras and everything, it's not really competition. It's a nice, healthy little rivalry, maybe sometimes, but it's really, I think every musician in the BSO would want to hear L.A. do Shostakovich and vice versa. So
just
it's
to
actually,
hear the difference. Yeah,
like
exactly.
I said, really healthy to bring in other orchestras from around the world and in this case on some pretty familiar territory with the music. So that's terrific.
And then the second orchestra is actually a mouthful, Orquestra de l'Accademia Nazionale de Santa Cecilia. I've been practicing that.
You should be on the radio.
Not at all. and with all respect to Maestro Papineau, I think the curiosity factor here is Martha Argerich. I mean, she's revered. I have followed her music for so long, and the fact that she'll be here doing Prokofiev 3, I think it's an exciting moment. I think that'll be just terrific to hear.
And it's worth pointing out that when we talk about, you know, the translation National Academy Orchestra of St. Cecilia, Academy doesn't begin to, like, describe how powerful this orchestra is.
It is one of the major orchestras in the country. I think it's just the traditional name of often the hall itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And where they perform and where they've come from. And they have a long-standing relationship between Papineau and Argerich. I think that'll be fascinating, because she hasn't been here in quite a long time.
Oh, yeah, I don't even know. I don't even know when the last time was she was here. But the nice thing as well is that along with the concerto that she's performing by Prokofiev, there is Italian music on this program. You want an Italian orchestra to play Italian music.
And I don't know that I've seen a program with both Fountains and Pines of Rome. Usually you get one or the other, but
right.
Both of them should be pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, that'll be really fun.
And then we have a subscriber bonus. So if you do subscribe to the season, which only takes 3 performances, you'll receive a complimentary ticket to the NEC Philharmonia led by Hugh Wolf. I hope people understand what a really exemplary student orchestra does not begin to do it justice to how
right.
good they are.
Yeah.
And this is part of their 150th anniversary celebration, so I think that's exciting. And they also have brought a new commission for their 150th, a Aaron J. Kermes piece, as well as Debussy Lemaire.
Yeah.
And the Bernstein, part of the Bernstein tribute serenade with Inmo Young, who's I've heard him several times, a really, really accomplished young violinist.
Right. And 2018 is the centenary, so there's going to be a lot of that going around anyway.
Absolutely.
So NEC. And no, Hugh Wolf, I mean, he's built that program over a number of years
amazingly.
Now. I mean, I will now give my personal note that I was a member of that orchestra many, many years ago. And yeah, it was good. I mean, we played well and everything, but I hear them now. And I just don't think that when I was in school there, it was anywhere close to the kind of capability that they bring to everything they do.
I think in Boston, we're a little bit spoiled between BSO and NEC Philharmonia, but you could put NEC Philharmonia in almost any city in America and it would rank as a resident orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
They're that good,
right.
Even being that young.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about pianists next. Let's just kind of get a handle on these terrific soloists who are coming in. There are 4 separate concerts that are going to be given at Symphony Hall and at Pickman Hall and at Jordan Hall. Daniel Trifonov has been here before. Have Celebrity Series presented Daniel Trifonov before?
We presented his debut here in Boston.
Right. That's right. That's what I thought.
At Longy School of Music at the Pickman Hall in our debut series there. It was just after he had won, you know, his bucket full of awards.
Yeah, he did all the Chopin, impromptu?
Some of the impromptu, and then
Preludes.
He also did the Firebird Suite. I mean, it was all competition pieces. It was
right.
quite a massive program.
Yeah.
What I recall mostly is that he was changing it. He changed it 4 times before the actual concert, including the day before. And I think it was simply, I'm a young pianist. I just won all these awards. I really want to make a show. I really want to make an impression on people. And he did. And we had him back at Jordan Hall 2 years ago, I think. And this one's a really interesting program because he's performing with his teacher, Sergei Babayan, well known in his own world. But I think he does it both in tribute to his teacher and out of sheer joy of playing with his teacher. And it's repertory that's not very, it's probably well known, but not heard very often on the concert stage.
Hmm.
Pieces for 4 hands, pieces for 2 pianos. And of course, you know, Jordan is one of the places that has 2 beautiful Steinway, you know, Hamburg and American. So just to hear that quality in that kind of hall, I think is going to be really exciting and really interesting.
Right, right. I mean, the idea of chemistry between a teacher and student, aside from the repertoire at all, is something really to be, that you want to be in the presence of. You want to see these people work together. Rafael Blekach is sort of like in that spot now himself, where he won some major competitions, and he's coming, and this is his debut.
This is his debut. We continue the debut series, which has been a terrific success for us, because we wanted to introduce young artists not the very start of their career, but early in their career arc. And with the idea that they probably would come back over time, so our audiences could, A, get to know them in a more intimate setting of Pickman Hall, and then watch as they grow, both musically, personally, over their career, how do their performance of pieces, the same pieces sometimes, how does their performance of new pieces, you know, that arc, which has frankly been part of Celebrity Series with some artists, over the many decades that we've been here.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of the arc, then you have Maurizio Pollini. I mean, not that it's the end of the arc necessarily, but I mean,
he's certainly in the latter stages of it,
but
still performing beautifully, and had him here a couple of years ago. He still wants to perform. Each time I would expect, this was the last, was he'll say, no, I think I'm done. But he doesn't. He enjoys it. He's still playing at a very high level. And certainly, you know, people, we have legions of fans who just, you know, probably through recordings mostly, grew up with him in a sense of listening to all those performances. And I don't know the program yet, but I suspect it will really be in his sweet spot, which I think everyone is hoping for.
Yeah, yeah. And Yuja Wong, speaking about of building an audience, I mean, she's just like a phenomenon. People, she came to Tanglewood, I think, was it last summer or the summer before? And it was, the people that were there clamoring just to be there in the shed for her performance, it was amazing. It was sort of like this extra electricity around the campus, you know? And that's going to happen when she's at Jordan Hall in May.
And she's been there a couple of times for us. She is a phenomenal pianist, just the power and the accuracy and the speed, everything. People have heard about it, but then she's really built a career. I mean, she has sustained her musicality, but also broadened in the sense of how she's developed over time. Where she's very young, but she's not the new young thing anymore, because she's been concertizing for a decade or so.
Right.
So again, watching that artist that we know develop and mature, and when we eventually see the program, I think it'll be exciting, and I have no doubt that'll be one of the more popular ones on this season.
Well, she's really interesting, because I think that, quite honestly, I think there were some skeptics in those early years when she kind of burst onto the scene. There's like, can she really sustain this? And what's really the level of depth she can bring? She could do anything. It seems like she's always been able to do anything on the keyboard, so she can always be amazing. But now, you're right, she's at this point where, there's years of a career now to look on, and there is this depth. There is a certain perspective that she brings, even as she's doing things that are sort of like unbelievable as you watch it happen. Yep. So I think you're right that there's a sense of her career being almost at a, I wouldn't say relaunch, that's not fair, but it's like it's a new kind of level.
Yeah, I mean, often we will think sometimes about artists as having their early stage career or mid stage career or later stage career, and without putting numbers to that, but she's moving beyond that early stage, into the real depth of her career. And I think it's being reflected in the kind of programs she does. I think it's reflected in the performances. And frankly, it's also reflected in her lack of boredom. I mean, you do see some pianists who kind of just burn out. But I think her appetite for new works, her appetite for continuing to perform is just as strong as it was in the very beginning, and that's really impressive.
Yeah. She's taken on some collaborative projects, I think, with some other musicians that have really sort of, I think, probably been a factor. I don't know. I could ask her, or you could ask her, or somebody could, about like what that's done for her musicality and her view on her own repertoire. What does it do to collaborate with people? This will be a solo recital. It's not a collaborative, but that is an important part of her trajectory. So, okay, we've got major orchestras and we've got these solo pianists. We'll get to some more sort of in between here in a second. But first, I just want to ask you, Gary, because this, I talk to people who put together seasons for ensembles. And so they sort of have this known quantity of players and known quantity of which hall they're going to be in and all this. You have this extraordinary complex layer of all kinds of performers coming in. And so I'm really curious. I've always been kind of curious about constructing a celebrity series season and how you balance that. I mean, do you already know, for instance, well, I want two major orchestras and I want four pianists and I want this number of something else? I mean, is there some kind of like grid that you go to, or are you kind of shifting those pieces around from year to year?
Well, first, let me say that all credit goes to Amy Lamb, who is our director of artistic programming. She does just an extraordinary job and making all this come together. She really has that task. And when she and I sit down, we're often talking about sort of the big arc, the big picture of things.
Okay.
And it is not formulaic. It is not... must have four pianists, therefore, fill in the slot. I don't care who it is, we need number four.
Okay.
Even though at the same time, we will look at the pattern or the tradition, and we might say, yeah, we tend to have three to four solo pianists, so let's look at that territory. We wouldn't say, oh, well, this year, let's go for seven. Or let's go for six string quartets. Because we know both traditionally in terms of availability of the hall that we might be in Jordan somewhere. We're certainly going to be there a dozen times and probably 14 or maybe 16. And so if we're doing that, then yes, there is some calculation about, well, we certainly want a mix of chamber. We want a mix of soloist, instrumentalist, solo pianists.
Yeah.
Same thing with Symphony Hall. Mix gets a little broader there. And then some cases for the orchestras, you know, that often is has to do with money.
Yeah.
Because it's there certainly was a time when Celebrity Series was bringing in more orchestras. But orchestras are touring less because it's expensive for them, and it's very expensive for us.
Yeah.
And we're well aware that, you know, the Boston Symphony has such a large and growing audience, which is terrific. Mm-hmm. So we do want to be careful with our selection to sort of go, here's a nice contrast. Here's a nice, interesting difference. Here's a couple of years ago we had Leipzig. Here's, you know, out of the exact same tradition that, you know, you can, not to get too academic and say contrast and compare. But we do sort of think about that. And then often, sort of like even this coming season, it is off very much artist-driven.
Okay.
So Evgeny Kissin this year is coming with a chamber program, which he has not done before, and he's doing it with the Emerson Quartet. You know, when he says, this is a project I've taken on and I'm interested, our first response is, well, that makes us interested.
Yeah.
And that's more about, well, let's grab that. And we're not thinking, oh, gee, that takes one of the boxes away from X, or we don't have room for it, because... Evgeny has been here many times for us, and again, being artist driven, it's like if they say this is what I want to pursue, that's who we respond to.
Yeah.
So we do want to present that. Or, as I mentioned before, Daniil Trifonov, you know, doing a two piano program. After it so happens that we have a second two piano program in Jordan Hall. In this case, it's Afro-Cuban jazz between Chucho Valdez and Gonzalo Rubalcaba. Quite different,
yeah.
But yeah. That's serendipity.
Yeah,
there was no calculation on our part; it just kind of came up that way.
Yeah. So I should know this, but then how does that turn around for the experience of a subscriber? Do they get to sort of? I mean, you're balancing your presentations of different ensembles mm-hmm. and different halls and everything, and do subscribers have that option too to sort of mix up the kinds of things that they're able to put into a package?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we have, unlike many, when people hear the word subscription, I think they often think locked in, must buy a whole season, have to commit years in advance. and ours deliberately is extremely flexible.
Yeah.
You only need to buy three performances.
Yeah.
You can buy any three performances you want. You can buy different numbers of tickets for different performances. And we will anoint you a subscriber.
Yeah.
You get exchange privileges. You lock in subscription prices even for additional performances if you want to buy additional ones later in the season.
So you get a subscription of three concerts, and if you wanted to go to a fourth or fifth, you get the subscription price for those.
Even if it's 2, 3, 4, 6 months later.
How about that?
Because we in a sense, are responding and have been to, we know the audience is both curious and likes the diversity. Many of our audience have affinity towards certain genres. I'm a chamber music person, or I'm a jazz person, or I'm a dance person. But the data and all anecdotes are, but I like exploring. I like being curious, so I want to try this. And I think, and I hope, that Celebrity Series has developed enough of a reputation that there is a trust factor that we're, even if you don't know the artist, we're going to bring someone who's good, who is at that world-class level, And very often we're bringing people who've not been to Boston before because we think that's part of our role here. I'd like to say that if we were not here, in a sense, you would have to go to New York or Paris or London or Shanghai to see the kind of artists and the range of artists that we're presenting. And we think that's a good complement to all the incredible richness that is resonant here in Boston and in the different institutions and organizations.
Yeah. You already sort of tantalized a little bit with the small ensemble lineup that you have for this coming season with Evgeny Kissin and the Emerson Quartet. They're doing Mozart, Fauré, and Dvorak at Symphony Hall. So, I mean, that's going to be a real event concert to begin with. But the small ensembles, I mean, it's maybe kind of tricky to even make that category because there's so much diversity going on in this, right? But some of the others, Takash Quartet, I mean...
Takash has been here a few times and they're coming back. They've become really a favorite, with the audiences.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to see them develop and continue on. We clearly have three or four quartets that we're bringing back pretty regularly these days.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have ensembles like Eighth Blackbird, very contemporary, have been here before with Celebrity Series, but it's been a few years, so it was, great to have them back.
I was at that concert.
Oh, wow.
The last time they were. They've only been here once.
Yeah.
They did the debate. Yeah, and it was at Sanders Theater.
Sanders Theater.
And I don't know that I've ever been so astonished in a concert at what they do. I mean, I knew they were already good. I already even knew intellectually, well, they do everything from memory. But then to see them do that and to see them walk around on stage and do all these things that didn't even sometimes involve their instruments, it was mind-blowing what they did.
I think they have been redefining, in a sense, what—and it's really interesting, what is the concert experience going to be like in the future for all of us? There's all sorts of dynamics going on, and I think they're at the forefront of exploring that, both for themselves, what's their experience like as artists performing, but what then, how does it translate to an audience? How do we experience it as we see that or watch something that, looks sort of out of place because it's different than what we're used to?
And
we have, the great range of it, the different kinds of things. I mean, one of the ones I'm quite excited about, I have not heard it, but I've seen, read many good things about it, is Jeremy Denk doing the Eyes Project, which
gosh,
I think
is
going to be extraordinary, doing the Eyes violin sonatas, but in a sense doing it with a contextualizing them, using a group of singers that, will really give the context of this is what the original hymn was. And then... Ives clearly took American folk music and hymn music and extrapolated it, pulled it apart, deconstructed it, whatever you want to describe, and put it back together. And I think with Jeremy's, clear cerebral interest in the content of the music that he presents, and with Stéphane Jacquif, I think it's going to be a really fascinating concert and for pieces that many have not heard before.
Yeah, so that's in January. And so it's the three violin sonatas or four violin sonatas that Charles Ives wrote. And as you mentioned, Ives' music draws from so many sources that Jeremy's going to be able to present those sources kind of right there in front of us. And not that it's going to be lecture demonstration.
No.
I'm sure that Jeremy knows how to put on a concert and make it utterly compelling. But it is this deep dive in a way that you don't normally get. And Jeremy, I mean, his just the way he writes, kind of shows his brilliance. It's not sort of just smart writing. It's really, really engaging, kind of funny, very unexpected kind of writing. And that's what I expect he brings to the stage, too.
Yeah, his blogs are terrific. And even his selection of music. I mean, the Ives will be terrific, but his last recital, how he found this, who knows? But to find a ragtime version of Wagner's Tannhäuser, wickedly hard to play.
I would imagine.
And yet he went through it because he really wanted to explore the concept of a recital built around rhythm and syncopation. And had discovered this and thought, well, this is just the perfect piece for, the middle of the recital.
Yeah.
And I think that reflects who he is, and I think it'll be a terrific addition.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's Avi Avital is a guy that we've gotten to know here at the station pretty well, and the Assad brothers, the guitarists, Sergio and Oder Assad. I didn't realize that they were getting together to do some things now, but it seems like such a natural combination.
They do know each other, and I think they've worked together in the past at different times, but they've liked it, which is why they said, oh, good, let's go tour this.
Yeah.
But it is a natural combination because Avital was here before and just really stunned the audience with the technical execution, but also the real passion for the music that he was playing.
Yeah.
And the Asads have always had that really natural and kind of deep connection to the audience, both through their music, but also through their, frankly, just sheer joy of playing together as a family. We've seen various incarnations of their family, extended family, playing together. For the two brothers and Explore with the Mandolin, I think it's just going to be fascinating.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned a few minutes ago the idea of serendipity, and I think that, you know, I remember, was it a couple of years ago that just the way the schedules worked out, you ended up bringing in Leipzig and the San Francisco Symphony, like within a week and a half or something like that. And I thought that was fantastic. I mean, yeah, it sort of like got all those orchestras grouped into one particular place, but because of that proximity, we really heard something. I kind of see a little bit of serendipity now that we're talking about Avi and the Asad brothers. There's a little bit of a plucked string serendipity going on in this season. I mean, you've got Avi and the Asad brothers, mm-hmm. and then you've got Chris Thiele, who's like a genius, actually certified genius in a way.
Exactly.
And then Wu Man, the pipa player, and the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain. I mean, these are incredibly diverse voices, but they're all dealing in this plucked string instrument kind of way. And so, I don't know, describe a little bit about Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain. What exactly is going on with that?
You will see more voiced ukuleles and different size ukuleles than you ever realized existed. bass ukuleles and sopranos and super soprano ukuleles. And they, again, they just play with a lot of joy and a lot of irreverence.
Yeah.
About themselves, it's a ukulele and it's a ukulele orchestra playing familiar tunes, commissioned tunes. And the audience just had a great time. I mean, it's a fun concert.
Yeah.
It's a serious because they're really fine musicians, but it is really about a fun, really accessible concert.
Right, right.
And I think Wu Man, who's been with us before, she's an extraordinary pipa player.
And the pipa being the Chinese instrument that's sort of, I'm not sure what the appropriate, maybe small lute might be the
lute,
right
four
way
string.
To, yeah.
And then the other strings, there'll be a couple of, essentially, they're almost like zither. They're played with bows on two strings, and there's other with four string. I think one's called essentially the moon guitar or moon banjo, sort of the shape of the body. And these instruments, are not terribly familiar. They're getting more familiar, certainly, in the West.
Right.
Because they do have a very distinctive sound. But I think now what I like about it is the shadow puppet notion. It gets into a little more theater than we traditionally do. But it also helps contextualize some of that music because a lot of that music is out of a folk narrative tradition. It's out of storytelling tradition. And so here we'll have both the music and the song and the visuals as to sort of what's going on here. And I think this came out of Wu Man's travels and discoveries and going back to her roots. And I think it really was wanting to a simple desire to share with others, to share with, and for us, to share with our audience, tradition that is thousands of years old, mm-hmm. But just not familiar. Just as legitimate, if that's even the word we should use, just as virtuosic, as Beethoven string quartet.
Yeah.
So I think that, again, the variety we're excited about. And again, it was serendipity. It wasn't calculated that we would do all these plucked instruments.
I don't know. Maybe I just gave you an idea there, Gary, a marketing campaign, the plucked string
the
subscription
plucked string
series.
Subscription series. Yes. This is the year of the string. And of course we have other things in other genres. We don't have to go into detail, but a really rich jazz program. I mentioned the Chucho Valdés, Rubalcaba duo on piano, which I think would be quite fascinating. Jazz at Lincoln Center is coming back in the Pops setup. So I think that's just kind of a fun, different kind of experience.
Yeah.
Anat Cohn with her band is terrific. And one I'm quite proud of, it's not a surprise at all, but bringing back Alvin Ailey, which is a great company. People know it well. It's easy to kind of take it for granted. But next year will be the 50th anniversary of the first performance of Alvin Ailey here in Boston. They were presented in 1968 by Celebrity Series, by Walter Pierce, for one performance at John Hancock Hall. And, you know, to imagine what it was to bring an all-black American company to perform in Boston in 1968,
yeah,
for me, it's really a very proud moment to sort of say, you know, for many decades, Celebrity Series has been, you can say, at the forefront. It's been on the ground floor about really taking some risks, really taking some bold steps, really introducing people that, who knew 50 years ago that Ailey was going to become the kind of national juggernaut that it is in some ways.
Right.
And wildly popular and beloved. So for me, that's a nice milestone to be part of the season.
No, absolutely.
And I mean, with the debuts coming in, as we mentioned, and you know, the return certainly of, you can call them veterans or just dear friends, back in the Chamber Arena, Manny Axe, Leonidas Kavakos, and Yo-Yo Ma doing a trio program at Symphony. It's another serendipity that this is the year they chose to do it. They've wanted to do it. They can fit it in their schedule. We're delighted to have them on the season.
You mentioned anniversaries and, you know, 50 years of Alvin Ailey. That's a, I agree that that's a nice way that Celebrity Series can historically contextualize Alvin Ailey coming back in. There's a whole other category of anniversary that is going to be honored in November when the St. Thomas Boys Choir comes in celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. but you know, that aside, this is a group with just, I mean, legacy doesn't even begin to describe what this group
sure.
is about.
And I mean, these are young kids, highly trained. It's a beautiful choir.
And when I say St. Thomas, I'm not talking about New York either.
Yeah,
this is St. Thomas, Leipzig.
St. Thomas, Leipzig, it's been around, you know, back to Bach days. It's Bach's choir. And the fact that it's actually a Boston debut for them both surprises me, but, you know, we're a little slow. 400 or 500 years later, we'll get around to it.
There was that pesky problem of the Iron Curtain for a while.
Yeah, well, glad that's over and
yeah,
glad that they're coming. But I think it'll be, again, we've presented choirs before, but it's not that often. And so I think it's a nice treat to have that in the mix.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's you know, there's so much Bach that exists in this town that just kind of runs through the course of a season from other presenters and other and certainly all the organs that are in town. So I think that that including them in the series is fabulous. I mean, it's this real tangible connection to Bach. And then some terrific singers as well beyond the St. Thomas Choir. Jamie Barton is a mezzo-soprano that I've heard about, but I haven't actually heard yet.
Her career, certainly at the Met Opera, is really taking off, and we're delighted to put her in have her come here in recital. She'll be part of the debut series at Pickman Hall at Longy School of Music, as well as Julia Bullock, a soprano. And then I think a really interesting combination is Lawrence Brownlee and Eric Owens, tenor and bass
yeah.
baritone.
Yeah, yeah.
Good friends, wonderful artists. I think that combination is really going to be interesting. And then, you know, all-star, you know, member of Celebrity Series, Rob Capello, bringing Jessica Rivera with the songs of Leonard Bernstein also as part of that centennial tribute. So lots of great voices coming through.
Yeah. What have you noticed? I mean, when we're talking now about the construction of a season and we're talking about the ways that subscribers can tap into whatever parts of the season they kind of want to, what do you hear from your audience and especially subscribers about what it is they want? And has that changed very significantly over the last few years?
I think there have been some changes happening, both in Boston and I suspect it's national as well. Certainly our audience articulates a desire and interest in variety and diversity. That's been Celebrity Series for, you know, 78 years. But what I'm also hearing is more curiosity about what's new.
Okay.
So if you look back in our archives, you could see that, I think I remember looking, Jean-Pierre Rampal, the wonderful French flutist, I think performed 23 out of 25 years at one point over the course of the series. That kind of programming is not happening anymore. People definitely have their favorites. They want to see Yo-Yo again, or they want to see Takash, or they want to see Palabolas. And, you know, we're able to do that. But I think there is more curiosity about new, younger, different, didn't know about them, both in content, be it Wuman or ukulele orchestra, but also even in the classical mode. Who are the new artists? What's going on with them? And then they'll show their affinity. You can feel it in the house. You know, they're kind of either going, yes, that's great, I really want to hear more. Oh, that was interesting. I want to hear someone different now. So I think that curiosity is definitely influencing how we look at the artist and who we're looking at. The source of that may be just pure technology of everything from, you know, back to my youth, LPs on through CDs to, you know, download anything now or watch it on YouTube. So I think people are more aware of what's happening in a broader range of places, travel, between festivals and over in Europe. But I don't think you'll see from celebrity series in the coming years that sort of, oh, let's bring someone back every single year. I mean, we do have some of those artists, but not that many.
Well, and it goes both directions too, right? Like, so it might just be my perception, but you keep up with this way more than I do on a regular basis. It seems like artists are also more curious about the new. Artists are more interested now than they used to be in this cross-pollination, in the collaboration, in the sort of genre busting, you know. It used to be that it was really extraordinary when somebody could play jazz and classical music in one program. Now it's not commonplace, but it's just that there's a lot more sort of grasping that and really taking advantage of it. And so it sort of feels like, I'm not sure who's leading who, the audience or the artist, but it does feel like there is a sense of exploration that's even more active now than it used to be on the part of the artists.
I think there really is. I mean, not too many days ago, we had Hilary Hahn, who is active, you know, just passionate about
right.
new music.
Yeah.
There are two new pieces on her program. So I do think you have artists who are deeply interested in new works, new content. I think you have artists who really want to explore their own personal musical journey and experience. So even if you say, you know, that Yo-Yo and Manny and Leonidas coming back and doing a trio, that's not exactly new news. But the reality is for them, they haven't played together in a long time.
Right.
So their personal experience is, I'm at a stage in my career, I want to play with the folks I want to play with.
Yeah.
And I think that's both great and going to be really interesting for us.
Yeah.
And then the cross-genre things happen, you know, between some of our debut series, certainly our stave sessions, which will come back and we'll make announcements about that a little later in the season. But that exploration is, I think, driven by, again, some technology, globalization. Our artists that you see here are traveling to Paris, London, Shanghai, Sao Paulo. They're all over the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think they're experiencing and seeing things there that, you know, pique their interest and they want to pursue it.
And the stave sessions, as you mentioned, well, that comes in a sort of separate announcement once that it's a separate project in a way. But I also know that part of, because we talked about it when you initiated the stave mm-hmm. sessions, that part of that was your own desire to learn
sure.
from what really hits the mark and what is what you find from an audience when these artists are presented, the artists that are really doing completely unique things that kind of don't fit into any category yeah. particularly. And you're presenting them in this concentrated way, which is really cool too. But I wonder at this point now, a couple of years in with the stave sessions, what have you learned? What is it that you're picking up from the energy of those particular concerts that might be filtering back and informing the way that you're putting together the entire Celebrity Series season?
And I think there's a couple of ways I would answer that. One is, I think audiences are deeply, deeply desirous of intimate connection. Yes, you could say social engagement. I don't quite mean the whole social digital thing, but it's there.
Yeah.
I think they are really interested in what the artists have to say, not just perform. So I think even if it's just musically performed, an artist says, well, this is what I'm interested in. I think that is being reflected in the audience and curiosity about, oh, that tells me something about you as an artist that I didn't know.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I just need you to play the pieces that I rehearsed when I was trying to learn the piano, you know, some 10 years ago. I think the other thing I've learned, which is more of a validation or reaffirmation of the very reason we started Stave Sessions, and the way I've put it, and not to be too much on the therapy couch, but one of the reasons I'm in this business is I always wanted to work with minds that were more original than my own. and artists are original minds. And so watching how they make connections and how they think about things and how they, you know, we just had a percussion group, Teague, perform with Inov Guana, a Moroccan, basically Guana, secular music being performed. And, you know, they explored connections and rhythms that were cross-pollinating their own ideas. And I think that sort of curiosity is so admirable. And, you know, it teaches me to just go listen, just open and be open to it. I'll often talk about one of the things I look for when we're looking at artists are artists who are capable of being vulnerable. And what I mean by that is they're willing and able to open themselves up and go, here's my music. You know, it's not just Chopin's music. Here's my music. This is who I am. This is what I have to offer. And they're willing to meaning be open to the audience's reaction to that. Because without that vulnerability, I think you don't really get that kind of transformative experience that we've all had in the concert halls. And yes, there are some artists who, you know, we can call them the Glenn Gould types, who, you know, exist in their own kind of space.
Yeah.
They're brilliant. They can absolutely be brilliant, but I don't think you have that same sort of almost human connection that you can when you sort of see that, yes, this may not be easy for the artist, or yes, they love what they're doing. So I think the live experience in intimate settings, when the artist really reveals themselves, that's gold.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I ask you this whenever we have these kinds of conversations that look ahead, Gary, and you're the consummate professional running this series, and you know all the moving pieces, and you set up everything, and you're enthusiastic about everything on the series. But I just have to ask you, from your own personal perspective, what are you really, really looking forward to in this coming season? You can even name more than one if you want. Tell me what Gary Dunning just absolutely cannot miss.
Well, I go to all the performances, and I love them all. So it's, you know, it's a little unfair to sort of go, you got to have a favorite.
I'm being
this.
Unfair. That's
everything's,
true.
Everything's my favorite. But as a past trumpet player, you got to love Canadian brass.
Yeah. First of all, I didn't know you played the trumpet. And secondly, immediately when you said it, I knew what you were going to talk about.
But I did a lot in college. And I remember getting that first album and going, it was the transcription of the Bach Passacaglia. And you kind of go, boy, that's really cool.
Yeah.
They're
totally inspirational. If you played the trumpet, Canadian brass is totally inspirational. And personnel has changed in that ensemble now, but they are doing the same thing. And the personnel that is doing it is every bit as virtuosic as the original Canadian brass. And their showmanship is just utterly so smooth. They are so good at what they do that it is utterly entertaining.
That's an easy fun one. But I do think I would probably pick for myself, the ones who are really going into new territories. You know, the Jeremy Denk's, the Ives recital, I think is just different and interesting. Eighth Blackbird. There's a dance company we haven't talked about too much, but company Aquarop. It's a French hip-hop company. I think, again, kind of pushing their boundaries. So I'm always curious when we're programming, I don't want to say at the edge, but it's kind of like that. Artists who are taking us to a new space. I think that's really interesting. It's challenging. Some of the audience sometimes struggle with that, but I think that's what we look to artists to do, take us to a new place, think of something we haven't thought of before, look at something we know well with perhaps a different lens.
Yeah. Someone just said in a separate conversation that it's when we're uncomfortable that we're sort of most open to learning something new.
Sure.
And that's the kind of thing you're talking about. And you know, as you're talking about those personal connections that you're really learning from the stave sessions about and everything, the way that the audience and the vulnerability, it really does occur to me that I look through the schedule and of the performers I know on this schedule, which is a lot of them, not every one of them, but a lot of them, they are defined by this sort of charisma, you know, this sort of way of connecting across that boundary of the stage and audience. I think of Avi Avital as one of those guys that just, you know, he's there and you feel like he's your best friend while he's playing. He's there for you. And I think that the series is really defined like that. So, Gary Dunning, thanks for spending a lot of time talking with me about the Celebrity Series of Boston.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Gary Dunning is the executive director and president of the Celebrity Series of Boston, and you can learn more about the upcoming season of the Celebrity Series at our website, classicalwcrb.org.
This Sunday night on WCRB in concert with the Boston Early Music Festival, Kathy Fuller brings you a concert by the London Haydn Quartet. WCRB's Alan McClellan got together with Catherine Manson, the group's first violinist, and he began by asking her what it is that makes Haydn so special.
Oh, everything's special about Haydn. If you play string quartets, Haydn is just the absolute master. I mean, he's very correctly referred to as the father of the string quartet for having basically invented the genre. Before that, there were no sort of large-scale works for two violins, viola and cello. And he sort of invented it and then took it, this new art form, to just higher and higher degrees with every piece that he wrote. I first played a Haydn quartet when I was 7 years old and was absolutely thrilled with it. And basically that's been the passion of my life, has been playing Haydn quartets ever since.
And the same with the others? I mean, it's not that they started when they were seven, but they've had similar
experiences. Well, pretty much, actually. I mean, yes, very, very much. My brother and I grew up, we were very lucky in Scotland that we were able to play chamber music from a very young age, which I think is incredibly important if you're studying music, is to play as much chamber music as possible, because that's where you really learn about music, from playing with others like that.
And playing in the historically informed mode is an extra challenge. Can you talk about what the challenges are there?
Yes. Well, we didn't actually start off planning to make a period instrument string quartet, but we planned really to play as much Haydn as possible. And then we were sort of drawn, almost without any of our own willpower being involved, we were just drawn to play it with gut strings and the bows of the period, and then we just got more and more entranced by that pathway and just found that the transparency of the textures is incredible in this music. The way he's written the music is just incredible, the part writing and the way the parts interact with each other and the different roles of the different instruments. And that is much, much clearer with the gut strings in the textures.
And the sound is so different. I guess it's partly the lack of vibrato.
Yes. I mean, there's just lots of things that just come naturally when you do play with those strings and with these bows, that there's just a different way of producing the sound. And that is just sort of inexorably linked with the whole aesthetic of the music and the style of the period. And one thing I find also fascinating when we play with the clarinet, as we're going to do in the Weber, with the old clarinet, the clarinet of that time, the combination of the clarinet and the strings together is also much, much clearer and much more equal voices than you ever hear with a modern string quartet and a modern clarinet.
Yes, I was really enjoying listening to the rehearsal and as you say, the clarity and the balance it seems perfect.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so I think that's really what those composers had in mind when they were writing for that combination. So it's definitely makes it much easier to bring that to life.
I was going to ask, how did you all meet the ensemble? Is it all different kinds of relationships of sorts? Your brother,
lots of different.
Your brother you met at a young age.
At a very young age, yes. yes, we grew up together, obviously. And Misha, our second violin, we met him sort of through friends of friends. And John actually was sort of almost a student of mine in years gone by, but I am now the only founder member of the group, so I had started it with a different combination of people, so it's a little bit of a complicated history.
Yes, that's a complicated answer. And how did you connect with Eric Hoprick?
Eric and I met at Santa Fe. We were both there for a Mozart festival, and we were playing the Mozart clarinet quintet together. We'd never met before or worked together, and just musically clicked instantly and played together for ages, and then ended up getting married.
I see. That's a beautiful thing. That's wonderful how those relationships develop. Yeah. So the program begins with Haydn, Opus 77, and I was noticing that Prince Lobkowitz is a common thread.
Yes,
that
exactly.
That Haydn wrote those quartets for the same prince that Beethoven wrote
exactly
his quartets, his Opus 18 quartets for. Yeah,
exactly. So just less than a 20-minute walk away from each other, the two composers were writing. One was writing his last complete quartet, and the other was writing his first complete quartet. So it's an extraordinary thought, and for the same patron. How I always think how what it must have felt like for Beethoven to have the guts to embark on writing string quartets when there were already more than 70 complete masterpieces by Haydn, which were already very well known and popular pieces. And I think it must have taken quite a bit of courage, which is not something that Beethoven lacked, but but he made it his own form as well, in the way that Haydn had done. But I mean, it just took a different direction. But it was a complete master of it, obviously.
What incredible self-confidence to be able to say, I think I could add to that genre.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think he probably didn't do it lightly, but he did do it, thankfully.
Was Haydn's relationship with the prince somewhat different than Beethoven's?
That's very hard to know, actually. I mean, I think that particular prince was very involved in Viennese society and very much known as a music lover and an amateur musician himself, and loved to have people round to his palace to play music with. So I think he was a very very loved man. I think he was a very nice person, and they were all... I think he died bankrupt, actually. I don't know quite how he had managed to bankrupt himself, maybe by commissioning too many string quartets. But that's right, because, in fact, Beethoven didn't get paid for some of his commissions from Lobkowitz. Anyway, that's a side issue. But he was very much a sort of admired figure among the musicians of Vienna at the time.
I read where some of his friends thought he was crazy to be spending so much time with music.
Yes, exactly, yes. Yeah, nobody could see the benefit of it. And now, isn't it funny, because, I mean, we know the name of Haydn and Beethoven, and very few people know the name of Lobkowitz, let alone the people who thought that he shouldn't have anything to do with music.
Exactly. So then we have Weber, which is a little bit later, right?
Yes. Sort of 15 years later than the Beethoven. But it is extraordinary how music develops at this juncture that... so many of these composers start overlapping with each other. I mean, it's astonishing to think that Wagner was born in the year that Haydn died and all of this, and that only 6 years later, this Weber... It must have been an extraordinary time to live and see what the next piece of music was going to sound like.
Weber didn't write all that many pieces of chamber music, I think. Is that right?
No, not so many. No, exactly. He did write a great deal for the clarinet because of his friend Baumann, the great clarinetist, influencing Weber to write these concertos and concertina and the grandeur. Yes.
The other thing I was going to ask you was, if you were speaking to a friend about what they might enjoy in this concert, how would you, what would you tell them to look out for?
What I think is actually very interesting about this program is just the context that each piece puts the others in, partly because of the date of the works, partly because, in any case, it's very rare to hear any of these works played with period instruments, actually. There are just not many period instrument string quartets that are active in the world today, let alone with an early clarinet as well. And also just this, I mean, Haydn has traditionally been used as the kind of amuse-bouche at the beginning of the program, and then you move on to more serious matters. In this case, this Haydn is an absolutely immense piece, and it's a very kind of mighty work. It has a huge scope. So we chose it deliberately to show that this is no sort of lightweight frippery to be sort of passed over lightly, but it's a real sort of serious piece to think about. And then Beethoven, I think in this particular Beethoven, you hear the influence of Haydn a lot in many, many different ways. And I think it's actually always fascinating to hear Haydn and Beethoven played side by side, because you realize so much more of the similarities. But people talk a lot about the differences. There's a lot of repetition of the fact that Haydn was a sort of jokey composer and Papa Haydn, and no, wasn't he funny and witty, and Beethoven was very serious and dramatic, and I think these differences are actually not based on reality, and there's many, many more interesting things to observe about the two composers than those, and Haydn could be very, very serious, and Beethoven could be very, very funny as well, so it's nice to see those different sides of the composers. And then, yes, and then to have Weber, who in date terms was not so far away, but such a different type of music, much more operatic, much more vocal in its conception, I think.
I'm amazed that Beethoven took his string quartets particularly so much further, and yet Haydn was also strong and serious and
well, in a way, I think that you, in a way, it's not even possible to say that Beethoven took it further, because, I mean, Haydn, right from the very outset, was writing extraordinary pieces, and people very often underestimate the Opus 9s and the Opus 17s, which, and the 20s, which are comparatively early in his body of string quartets, but contains some absolutely miraculous music, and actually not altogether of a different sort than you find in the late Beethoven quartets even. So I would challenge you to find something that Beethoven had done that Haydn hadn't already done, in a way, or paved the way for.
You know, I've kind of heard Haydn in the typical sets, you know, and maybe not as much of the...
That's right. I mean, that was actually why we started the London Haydn Quartet, was because we realized that everyone knows the Opus 64s and the Opus 76s. So that's a dozen quartets out of the 70 available. And it was a complete revelation to us to discover the early ones. And still many of our musician colleagues have no idea about the early sets, because it's comparatively hard to program them, because people don't trust them because they don't know them, so it's a vicious circle. But so we decided that we would just champion these, all of the Haydn quartets, and spent our lives doing that, and just thrilled by it. And we've been lucky enough to be able to record the complete series as well. We're almost finished with it now, just a couple more discs to do, but
that is just an amazing achievement, actually.
It's been such a fantastic journey to take, actually, and just to really get to know all of those pieces in real depth, and just what a privilege. Amazing.
Well, that's wonderful. May it continue, you know, with are there other explorations, other composers that you'd like to explore?
Well, certainly we've been absolutely relishing our exploration of Beethoven as well, and we've now played all the Beethoven quartets as well as all the Haydn quartets, and of course Mozart, and I mean, those are the sort of the main figures in our musical world, but of course others creep in. We did branch out and play a program with Haydn and Webern this summer.
So, wow.
To mix the first and second Viennese schools, which was actually phenomenal exercise as well. I mean, not exercise, that makes it sound sort of academic. It was just fantastic.
Did you play Webern on gut strings?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as Webern, in fact, heard it for the first time as well. We tend to think of playing with gut strings as some sort of freakish sort of modern invention, but in fact, there's only been about 40 years where anybody played on anything different, because it wasn't till after the Second World War that people actually changed from gut strings to metal strings. But it just happened to have been during our lifetime, so we think that that's the normal method. But in fact, for hundreds of years, people have played with gut strings and now have started to again. So
that's fascinating. Yeah, it's original instruments, Webern, kind of.
yeah. No, and again, the transparency of the texture makes all of the voices and the communication between the instruments just come to life in a completely different way.
I think that would be a fascinating thing to listen to.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I know you need to get away for a break. Catherine Manson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Catherine Manson is the first violinist of the London Haydn Quartet. You'll hear them on Sunday evening at 7 p.m. on WCRB in concert with the Boston Early Music Festival. And that's the answered question for this week. You can subscribe to TAQ at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. And you'll also find us on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to Gary Dunning and Catherine Manson, as well as the staffs of the Celebrity Series of Boston and Boston Early Music Festival for making these conversations possible. Thanks also to my colleague, Alan McClellan. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.